Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Today on the Brian Lehrer Show, what I learned at last night's public advocate debate.
Dan, you did not endorse Bill Thompson, the Democratic nominee. Dan, I recognize that you were a close ally of Mayor Bloomberg.
The truth is, Councilmember James has stood with Mayor Bloomberg 98% of the time, and that's not right.
So after co-moderating last night, I will break down some of the highlights and low blows and try to give you some of the main differences that became clear between Daniel Squadron and Letitia James, including if either was scandalously close to the mayor they're trying so hard to distance themselves from. Their runoff election is next Tuesday. We'll talk about that later in the show. Also today, Education Week continues in our 30 Issues election series. Today, Booker versus Lonergan, how your U.S. Senate pick might affect your child's education. And Christie versus Bono, how your choice for governor might as well. We'll ask what happens to Obama and Rouhani post-non-handshake. Should teenagers be allowed by law to erase their stupidest moments from the internet before applying to college or for work? And we have Sudhir Venkatesh today on New York City's underground economy. But we begin today with this underground economy question. Can you Yelp your way to riches? Can you Yelp your way to fraud? The New York State Attorney General, Eric Schneiderman, has secured agreements from 19 companies that either bought or sold fake testimonials on customer review sites like Yelp or City Search or Google. He joins us now. Attorney General, welcome back to WNYC. Hi.
Thank you, Brian. Good to be here.
I think we all assume this astroturfing of user reviews goes on, but what did you find?
Well, my office a little over a year ago started to notice a lot of challenges to the websites that do attempts, some better than others, to screen out and filter, what they call it, reviews that are suspicious. We realized there were a lot of them, so we decided to do an investigation to see how serious this problem of false reviews is. My undercover investigators posed as the principals of a yogurt shop in Brooklyn and called up companies to try and figure out if they could improve their online reputation. We discovered that there are two distinct types of schemes to distort the truth and that it goes far beyond anything I personally had ever realized. I mean, I look at reviews, you take them with a grain of salt, but you sort of can't help but getting caught up in the sense that this is probably a pretty good restaurant or hotel or service. But we discovered that there are a lot of companies that were paying their employees or friends of families and employees or just directing them to inflate the reviews. But beyond that, we discovered this entire industry, companies called reputation management companies or search engine optimization companies, that you can call, and they will very brazenly offer you to produce lots of false reviews and have people change their IP addresses to work on social networking sites. And we think that there's a much higher portion of the reviews online that are false reviews than we'd ever anticipated. So we've now closed down our investigation on 19 different firms that were involved in this process. We announced it and are now working with other AGs around the country and have preferred targets in their jurisdictions, because this is clearly much more of a national problem than we had realized.
And some of what you found was so blatant, like an ad for someone to write fake reviews for a spa that said, quote, "I need someone who is a Yelp expert to post positive reviews for a spa that will not be filtered using legitimate existing Yelp accounts, must have at least 10 friends on Yelp." So why do they think they can just advertise like that and get away with it?
Well, I think because this is the first law enforcement effort to do anything about it. I mean, I think this is something that, there's an interesting phenomenon about the Internet. We see it over and over again. People feel that it's not the same as lying or committing fraud or spinning in regular real life. And this is far more insidious, Brian, than regular false advertising. If you have a restaurant that says, "Oh, we have the best restaurant in the world, you know, come here," that's one thing. If you have these people who do add personal flavor to make it appear real, "Oh, we had a great time, my son felt ill and the maitre d' helped him out," it's very hard for anyone reading not to believe that that's the truth. It's worse. In false advertising, you at least know it is the restaurant, it is the hotel, it is the store spinning, and you can, use your sense of caveat emptor, let the buyer beware, to take
right.
it.
And here it's supposed to be independent. It's supposed to be your peers. It's peer review by definition.
And the worst thing is that once we started getting into this, we realized it went beyond stores and restaurants and basic services. We found reviewers of dentists. We found reviewers of lawyers. We found sleep clinics, ultrasound clinics. So this now starts to move into an area that implicates public safety. So we decided that even though we still had ongoing investigations, that we would get this out in public. We have been in contact with a lot of our counterparts around the country. We've referred targets that were based in other jurisdictions to others in law enforcement. And we're really attempting to do this. We're also in touch with the web posting sites to talk to them about how they screen this out, because they're filtering some cases better than others. But we're talking about systemic fraud here, and I'm a victim, and I think everyone else is. I was online last week looking at hotels in some other city where I have to go, and just reading all these great reviews by people who pretended they had been there. I don't know how many of them actually had been to the hotel.
And here's Anthony in Park Slope calling in to say that he's been a victim. Anthony, you're on WNYC. Hi.
Yeah, I'm a firsthand victim of the kind of deception that you can fall victim to when you believe these positive reviews. We hired a home renovation contractor who had been positively reviewed, and it turned out to all be fake. And we ended up with a mess to the tune of $100,000 around in damage that we're still litigating.
Oh, boy. How did you figure out that the reviews were fake, though?
After everything unraveled, we did more research, and it became pretty obvious.
All right. Thank you for your call. And my guest is New York State Attorney General Eric Schneiderman, who's gotten agreements from 19 companies that either posted these reviews by soliciting them, or they were the companies that that did them. And you give Yelp credit for cooperating with you on the investigation. But our WNYC news team, poking around after your release, found businesses complaining that Yelp sometimes pressures them into buying advertising with an explicit or implicit suggestion that that will improve their customer reviews. Do you have any indication that Yelp itself is gaming its users or the businesses it reviews?
Well, we did start out with the cooperation from Yelp, Google Places, other site posters. We are aware of other allegations. It is not uncommon for publications or internet sites to solicit advertising at the same time. They are, in the case of some newspapers, they solicit your advertising when you're waiting to see if they endorse you for office. But we've been looking at this also. I don't want to comment because these are ongoing investigations, but we are certainly challenging that industry to clean its act up. And it is very much in the long-term interest of sites like Yelp and Yahoo to restore credibility and maintain credibility for the online reviews, because that's why people go to their sites, which is ultimately what they need to do. So we're looking at every aspect of this, and I have to say that the one thing, at this point in my career, it's nice to occasionally feel like you're naive, but the brazenness of these online reputation management companies and search engine optimization companies is just outrageous. We called up as people posing as a yogurt shop. They were completely open about their entire scheme, and we've then went back and discovered all their advertisements, which they're posting online, saying we're offering $1 for every review. You have to be able to switch your IP addresses. It's a great way to make money on the side.
What's the penalty for a company like that after you, as Attorney General, go through the process? Are they shut down now? Is this the corporate death penalty, or do they have to, assuming they're guilty, do they have to pay a fine, or what's the penalty?
A lot of these are very small operations, so they essentially are shut down by any fine. We find them, but in each of our cases, we get an injunction that essentially stops them from engaging in this practice with much more significant penalties if we ever catch them again. And now that we're onto them, we're monitoring them. So it essentially stops. We're confident that we can stop the practice with the folks we find. And in some cases, we got injunctions against individuals as well as companies to make sure they don't just go down the road and open up a new company and start up. But this is, to a certain extent, we have done an investigation for over a year. We've established the parameters of the crisis and the scandal and the false reviews. With the New York State Attorney General's office, we are not, you know, able to police the entire country and the entire internet. So we are now, part of the reason we decided to make this public is we wanted to get it out there to all of our colleagues. And we've been in touch with dozens of other agencies in the last couple of weeks trying to transfer our knowledge and information so that this can start up in other states. And I know some of my counterparts in other states are starting this process. The challenge here, again, is the globalization of the internet makes everything harder from a law enforcement point of view. We have discovered that they hired people in Eastern Europe, in Bangladesh, to be these online reviewers. So if you think you're going to a periodontist in White Plains and you're reading a review, it could be some guy in Bangladesh just reading off of some talking points about what a great experience he had getting his inflamed gums fixed.
While you're here, let me touch on a couple of other things. And this is also from the high-tech world, this next one. You were talking yesterday about what you called insider trading 2.0. What's that?
Insider trading 2.0 is this very new, dangerous combination of high-frequency computer-generated trading on exchanges, on stock exchanges and to a certain extent, other exchanges, that is combined with early access to data. Now, we've had since Albert Wiggins shorted his stock in the Chase National Bank, which he was the president of back in 1929, rules on insider trading. So this is a well-worn area of American law. The point of insider trading 2.0 is that the new technology forces us to review our standing rules of law. We had an agreement with one firm, Thomson Reuters, that had bought the rights to publish University of Michigan survey, which comes out every month or two, on consumer confidence. They were giving it to their subscribers 5 minutes before it hit the public. But they were also giving a two-second edge to a much more elite group of folks who paid extra for it. And in the old days, that would be meaningless.
Two seconds.
In the world of insider trading 2.0, in the world of access to data, just a tiny moment before everyone else has it, they can not just make money, but move markets. And that was a test case for us, and we confirmed that in July of 2012, before we reached our agreement with Thomson Reuters, which I'm pleased to say has stopped this two-second advance release to an elite group, tens of thousands of shares in July 2012 traded right before the University of Michigan survey was released. In that two-second interval, we reached an agreement with them, and 1 year later, July 2013, it was down below 2,000 shares. So this is market-moving information, and some of it is not information that fits within the traditional categories we use for insider trading.
Line, you're calling on Washington to do something more about this at a regulatory level so you and other state attorney generals don't have to go after these incidents case by case, right?
Well, we are calling on Washington, but recognizing how challenging it is to get things done in Washington, and also recognizing what a threat this is to the integrity of the markets. Most of my outreach has been, and my speech yesterday was about reaching out to folks in the industry, because people who run regular brokerage firms and investment firms, they don't like this either. This is, no one buys stock for 10 seconds or a minute in order to build value, create jobs, develop products. This is not what American markets and American investing are supposed to be about. So I'm really looking for more help from our colleagues in the industry and more leadership. I hear anecdotal complaints from friends in the industry about high-frequency trading all the time, and there's been some attention, even in the absence of manipulation, to the catastrophic consequences of high-frequency trading running amok. And we know that the term flash crash came into our national lexicon after a particular computer program threw the markets completely out of whack in 2010. The NASDAQ was shut down earlier this year for three full hours because of a computer program gone awry. Right. This is something that's in the interest of the financial services industry, as well as the public and
Absolutely.
As well as the government actors.
One other thing before you go, the shocking indictment against William Rapfogel, CEO of the Metropolitan Council on Jewish Poverty. He allegedly stole millions of dollars over his 20-year tenure and used it for himself and for political donations. Now, his power derives partly from the fact that his wife, Judy Rapfogel, is chief of staff to Assembly Speaker Sheldon Silver. Is Speaker Silver under investigation?
No, this is you know, I can't comment because this is an ongoing investigation, but the documents we released yesterday when we arrested and arraigned Mr. Rapfogel indicate this involves him and a small group of Confederates. This is a scheme that predated his time as executive director of the Met Council. But I want to point out that this was called to our attention by an independent counsel hired by the board of directors of the Met Council on Jewish Poverty, who first alerted us to the fact that there were these sacks of cash around and there appeared to be an improper deal with an insurance company. This does not seem to go beyond Mr. Rapfogel and a small group of Confederates. We're still investigating, but I don't want anyone to get the implication, particularly because this is a charity that feeds hungry people, takes care of seniors, and in addition to being a prosecutor, I regulate all the nonprofits in the state, and I'm very concerned about the integrity of these systems. It's important to maintain the services while rooting out and punishing this kind of egregious misconduct of diverting funds that should have gone to help poor people for his personal use. But the board of Met Council has been working with us. They've hired a new executive director, and I think it is important to understand that this was a scheme that doesn't take anything away from the good services they deliver.
That's important to point out. But just to be clear, since you charge that there were hundreds of thousands of dollars stashed in the Rapfogel's multiple homes, is Mrs. Rapfogel not under investigation?
If the complaint speaks for itself, there are no allegations. There's no evidence that we have presented thus far that implicates anyone beyond Mr. Rapfogel and a small group of Confederates at Met Council. And then in this insurance company that essentially was overcharging Met Council and then kicking back the cash to the staff. So that the complaint speaks for itself. It's a tragedy. It's very sad when people use a charity, especially one that's supposed to help poor people, for their personal gain. But we want to be very careful about people jumping to conclusions about who else might have been involved.
New York State Attorney General Eric Schneiderman, thank you so much.
Thank you, Brian.
So people, some companies, as we heard from the Attorney General, try to plant good reviews about themselves on social media. Well, a new law in California will allow teenagers to erase some of their most embarrassing moments. You know, those extreme party pictures, those over-the-top political rants, or screeds against your former friends or lovers. You're allowed in some cases now, if you're still under 18, is my understanding, to get them deleted. So you can actually get a job or get into college, since everyone will probably Google you. Governor Jerry Brown signed this into law on Monday, but not everyone likes it. And with us now is a critic of the bill. He is Eric Goldman, professor of law at Santa Clara University School of Law, also director of the High Tech Law Institute there. And he wrote about this yesterday on Forbes. Professor Goldman, welcome to WNYC. Hello from New York.
Hello from California. Thank you for having me.
And listeners in California or anywhere else with a question or an opinion about this bill, you can call in 212-433-WNYC. And even relating this to Attorney General Schneiderman's crackdown on phony user reviews, folks, do you like these attempts to tame the Internet? Do you resent them? Do you think they are impossible in any case? Call us, 212-433-WNYC. 212-433-9692. Maybe you think the snoopers and the fraudsters will always win, so government should leave the Internet alone? Or what do you think? 212-433-9692. Or post to WNYC.org, click on Brian Lehrer Show, or tweet at Brian Lehrer. But remember, whatever you write may last on the Internet longer than a piece of styrofoam in a landfill. So, Professor Goldman, you point out that this law covers sites marketed to minors and not intended for a general audience of adults. So would that mean that sites like Twitter and Facebook, which adults and teenagers both use, would not be covered under the law?
There are two different websites or apps that are covered. One is, as you described, sites that are targeting teens or under, and the other are sites that know that they're dealing with teens or under. And so even Twitter or Facebook could be responsible for its users who they know are under 18.
And you're right that the law also restricts certain kinds of – well, before I get to that, you also point out another limit of the law is that not covered is when other people repost your drunken party pictures or your obscenity-filled hate rant. So teens shouldn't get too complacent, thinking everything they write on the Internet can be withdrawn at a later date?
Well, so the idea is it's supposed to be an eraser, but just like trying to erase a pen is really difficult, it's going to be very difficult for people to erase all the digital bits on the Internet. So there's lots of reasons why copies are made of postings, and this law only allows the minors to target one specific instance of that content.
When you say one specific instance, you mean their original posting of it, whatever site that appears on, from their own account?
That's correct.
So how much of an effect do you think this is going to have? How much do you think it's going to protect teenagers as intended by the legislature and the governor?
If the goal is to protect teenagers and other minors, it has a little effect. There's a small set of circumstances where taking down the original post and not touching any other copy of it would still ameliorate or solve the problem. Sometimes that's where all the debate is taking place, or that's where the heat has been focused. But in terms of avoiding the possibility that your employers are going to find out what you've done, I don't think the law is actually going to move the ball forward very much at all.
Listeners, has this ever happened to you? Have you ever applied for a job and been turned down because of something that the prospective employer was able to find by Googling you? Of course, they don't tell you that that's why you don't get the job, so it's hard to know, but maybe you learned about it one way or another. Has this ever happened to you? 212-433-WNYC. Or if you're a parent of a teenager, if you're a teenager right now, do you like the idea for California? Should it expand to other states where you can go on to at least the sites where you posted stuff and delete some things that are going to be especially embarrassing in the future? 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. And you can also react to Attorney General Schneiderman's investigation. And do you think it's good that the law is out to police the Internet in either of those ways, or do you think it doesn't matter anyway? 212-433-9692. And Professor Goldman, you don't seem to like the whole approach. You write on Forbes that you don't think any state has ever passed a beneficial Internet law. Wow. Should I take from that that you're a Forbes free market libertarian and your highest value here is government not mucking around in the marketplace?
That's one possible conclusion, but I'm an Internet law scholar, and I've been thinking about Internet law regulation for the last 20-plus years. And just as a matter of my own self-assessment of the data that I've seen, what has worked and what hasn't, I keep coming back to the conclusion that states aren't really well-positioned to regulate the Internet. It's not just about the borderless nature of the Internet. It's also that states tend to be fairly parochial in their interests and tend to be fairly unsophisticated in how they see the problems and then express the problems in statutes. So it just as I try to come up with a list of failures, I've tried to come up with a list of state success stories, and I actually come up empty.
So if the federal government was trying to do the same thing, you would feel differently?
I think that at that point, then, we've located the regulatory effort at the right level. Congress has the oversight over the entire country, not just their particular corner of the country. And that, I think, helps improve the quality of their output. In addition, there's a lot of lobbyists and other folks in Washington, D.C. that are paying close attention. It means that more voices are heard about potential problems with the law, as opposed to the state level, where there aren't as many people trolling the hall saying, you need to hear about my concern as well. And so having the action at the federal level at least ensures that there's going to be the kind of back and forth that will make a better law.
Lisa in Forest Hills, you're on WNYC. Hello, Lisa.
Hi, Lisa. Brian, thank you so much for taking my call. I think they should be allowed to take off their past history, because just I compare it to how there's way too much information out there on politicians that are nobody's business and have nothing to do with the issues. I don't think a teenager getting drunk at 15 years old should have any effect on their future potential job possibilities. So I agree with it.
So you like the idea. Let's talk to Jessica in Park Slope. Jessica, you're on WNYC. Hi.
Hi. So I moderate a Yahoo group, a neighborhood Yahoo group, and there was some posts from an individual who was complaining about the political a boycott that someone was
trying to lead or participating
about, trying to get people to go to. And he kept using inflammatory language, calling the poster stupid and saying that, you know, he was racist and things like that. And I kept trying to moderate the debate and just, you know, not get involved in the issues. But he kept coming back. So over the course of weeks, he was doing this. And then a few months later, I got an email from the poster saying, saying something along the lines of, hey, you know, I've rethought my posts, and I'd love it if you could take them down. And so I just assumed, you know, he was going, I couldn't figure it out at first, and then I talked it over with someone, and we just assumed he was going for a job or something, you know,
right.
and decided he didn't want this kind of thing, with him kind of looking, you know, sort of inappropriate online.
And what did you do? Did you take it down?
You know, I thought about it, and I took him down. I thought, you know, if, you know, I'll assume he's sincere, you know, and he had some time to cool off. It was an Israeli-Palestinian issue, so these things are very, you know, they create emotion.
Jessica, thank you. And that's a good story of voluntary cooperation between the now regretful poster and the moderator of a site. Professor Goldman, there's already some recourse, even before the California law, I guess through these voluntary acts, some recourse for teens to take down stuff even before the California law got passed, right?
In fact, most user-generated websites allow their users to control their postings. They allow them to edit them in the future. They allow them to delete the items in the future. That's a pretty common norm in the community. So the law is going to apply only in circumstances where a website or app has made some other choice for some reason, maybe legitimate, maybe not. And that's where the real action for this law is.
What about
otherwise,
big ones?
The
some of the big ones, some of the big ones like Twitter and Facebook, do they allow you to do that?
Yes.
They do.
Absolutely. And, Yahoo Groups typically allows people to delete. It depends on how it's structured. Most user-generated content websites give users control. That's the whole point. They're platforms for people to self-publish their content, and the authors remain in power, retain the power to control their posts. So there was a weird overlap between what the industry is already doing and this law that now says you must do that, even if for some other reason you decide that there's a better answer.
Mike on Long Island, you're on WNYC. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Brian. How you doing?
All right. What do you think?
I am almost physically getting ill here. The only thing this can really do is I have a six-year-old, and I'm trying to teach him that a handshake actually means something in this world. And all this is going to be teaching kids is that there's always going to be a way to clean up your messes instead of actually having to own up to them. And you have to think before you put anything online. And all this is taking the onus off of parents to actually have to parent. I think about, was it last week, 2 weeks ago, as an ex-football player, has a summer home in upstate New York. He's there once in a blue. All these kids break into his home, destroy his home and his personal belongings. He, instead of going crazy, he takes their tweets, because these kids were teenagers, takes their tweets, takes all the pictures, and publicly shames them and tries to put them on the right track. And now he's, like, I heard that some of the parents are trying to sue him for denigrating their kids, you know.
And you're saying good for him because they did this.
Yeah, they did. We're not, why are we giving parents outs and the kids outs? You did something. Own up to it.
So what happens when your sweet little 6-year-old, 10 years from now, is a snarky 16-year-old, which might happen no matter how good a father you are?
Well, he's already getting there.
Let's not get too far into that. But and then he does some stupid things on the web, and you're afraid he's not going to be able to get a job or get into that Ivy League college that he's otherwise qualified for. Should he not have a little second chance there?
Well, my wife and I have actually had this conversation. I'm not saying that he's not going to do stupid things. I've already told her I'm already expecting stupid things. But he has to. You have to understand, it's a different world, and you put something online, it is there forever. I mean, we've been hearing this for 10 years now. I'm 39 years old now, and it's like, okay, different world when I was a teenager, totally different world. But these kids, they're growing up with it. If the parents are not telling them, and the people they respect are not telling them, listen, think before you do. You're going to do stupid things. Yeah. It's going to happen. You're going to be 15, 16. You're going to have a drink. Right. You're going to smoke something, whatever you want to do.
Try to prevent it as much as possible by good parenting. I hear you. Thank you for your call. And Amina in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Amina.
Hi, Brian. It's actually Aminata. The lady got it wrong.
Oh, sorry. Right, of course. But it's you.
Yes.
And you're 15, is that right?
Yeah, I'm 15.
And what do you think?
Oh, I think it's great. I think it's a fantastic idea. I mean, like Facebook and Instagram, I believe they give you the right to delete it or take the post down. But I think it's a fantastic thing because, as the guy who was talking before, and as I can say from being a teenager, this is the time when people do the most stupid stuff in your life between the ages of 13 and 20, I would say. Like, you do so many stupid things, and to be able to have a delete button is amazing. Like, my mom has drilled into me that you have to think before you do, because as the guy was saying, stuff is going to be on the internet forever. What if someone shares your post or reblogs your picture? It is going to be there, so you have to think before you act. But having the option to delete it helps a lot, because I mean, you never know how it will impact your life later.
Even with the good parenting,
the best parent that you can be, but your child is going to want to experiment in some way, and they will learn from that experience, but they're going to want to, because this is the age where you try out things and you do some really stupid stuff.
Aminata, thanks so much for checking in on this. We'll take one more. Patty in Chappaqua, you're on WNYC. Hi, Patty.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I think it's a great idea. We hire a lot of student interns for our educational program, and when they send me their resume or send me an email, the first thing I do is Google them.
You do, huh?
And, yes, absolutely. And it's a lot more telling oftentimes than what's on their resume.
So what kind of thing has led you to deny somebody for an internship who you were otherwise seriously considering?
Well, obscene gestures. People always understand that students are going to be doing silly things, being drunk, doing things like that. But obscene gestures, things that really degrade their character, and if they're representing us, even as a student intern, we would hate for someone to say, oh, this is the kind of person that's representing you at a program or even helping you at your nonprofit. And it would just be embarrassing for someone to find that picture associated with us.
As someone who Googles prospective interns, what do you think of this kind of law? Should they have or not have that opportunity as teens?
Absolutely. You know, people make mistakes. People get tagged in friends' photos and don't often know that until quite late. So they have to have some recourse to be able to remove it.
But they'd be hiding it from you.
Well, I don't think an occasional bad photo means their entire character is in jeopardy. And except for in hiring someone, it could jeopardize me hiring them. But I don't think that it should ruin their career prospects or even getting into school.
Patty, I'm going to leave it there. Thank you very much. And a last word from you, Eric Goldman, director of the High Tech Law Institute at Santa Clara University Law School. This law just was signed by Governor Jerry Brown in California this week, allowing teens to go on to many websites and delete posts or photos or whatever. What do you think is going to be different a year from now?
Well, I actually thought there was a couple of good comments in the last few sets of calls. One is, I think we're going to have to redouble our efforts to teach teens and other kids how to be responsible when they post online. We can't change the fact that they're going to make kid mistakes. They're kids. We can't expect them to be adults. But we can teach them better, and I don't think we've had a chance to have a full generation of kids who've been taught about the power of publication and what they need to do to wield it responsibly. And the other piece is about deciding whether to hire somebody or not because there's a photo of them making an obscene gesture. The reality is that 10 or 20 years from now, every kid is going to have a photo where they've done something really stupid, and we're not going to be able to use that as a credible way of sorting between who's good to hire or not, or who's a good, trustworthy person or not, because we're all going to have that evidence about us. And so we're going to have a social adjustment about what do we do when we see that everyone's made mistakes, and how are we going to give them weight accordingly.
By the way, we have somebody calling in who we're not going to have time to put on the air, but he says he's a senior recruiter, and it is illegal to not tell your candidate that you're Googling them. Is that true, as far as you know, as an internet law scholar?
So I'm not an employment law scholar, and employment laws vary from state to state. I'm not sure that that's absolute as stated. But no doubt, doing research via Google of potential employees is something that is a dangerous game for employers, something they have to do very thoughtfully.
Professor Eric Goldman from Santa Clara University School of Law, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, what I learned at the New York City Public Advocate debate last night. Some of it will surprise you.